The lights are on red. We're away.
Listening to MotoGP OD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. My name is Jules Cisek. Today is Friday, November 28th, and this is episode number 155. The only news really I have this week is, of course, we had testing at Jerez and on Phillip Island. Honda, Yamaha, Ducati were testing at Jerez, and Suzuki and Kawasaki were at Phillip Island. What's become clear during these tests is that Valentino Rossi and Danny Pedrosa are definitely leading the field in testing so far. Their times are like 6 tenths faster than anybody else. And if Casey Stoner was at the test, which he isn't because he's recovering from his scaphoid surgery, which he's going to take about 3 months to recover from, I'm sure that he will join that group when he's back. The good news for the other riders is that Nicky Hayden and Sergio Bernal are doing well in the Ducatis. Actually, Kallio is as well. And we've got Suzuki and Kawasaki at Phillip Island, where Malcolm Alandri is doing really well. He's the fastest of the Kawasakis. That's good news for him. But Caparossi led the field about 0.2 of a second from his teammate. So the Suzukis are doing well as well. So that's it for the news. Sorry I don't have much more, but I have a lot of good stuff here in the show. We talked to Liam Schubert, finally, after all this silence. As any of you who follow Moto Liam's blog, there's been changes in his life. And you'll hear about it when we talk with him. And we also have a interview that Jim Race did with Eugene Laverty. It's very interesting, so we'll jump in with that first. Enjoy.
Hello there. This is Jim Race for MotoGP OD, and I have on the line with me Eugene Laverty, now of Park Algar Honda. And Eugene, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks. The last time that we had a chance to talk to you was at Indy at the GP, and back then you were on the Bluesons 250. Things didn't work out very well there, and unfortunately you had a bit of a get-off in the rain, and that started a whole different chapter in your road racing career. You went home, and you had a ride coming up with Yamaha Atelier. Can you tell me about the races that you ran with them?
Well, definitely a lot has changed since last time I spoke. Rode two rounds of the World Supersport Championship with Yamaha, and really that turned the season around and has now propelled me into the World Supersport Championship and with one of the front-running teams with Park Algar Honda. But at the time, it wasn't very good in Indianapolis when I crashed and injured both of my feet, and it looked like I was going to have to sit out the Vallelonga race, so it wasn't so nice. But then I turned it around, and within 5 days I was on the bike and then finished on the podium at Vallelonga, and that was that.
And so Vallelonga to you is a brand new track, and that race Donington was a bit of a trick for you because you'd headed out there and the whole weekend it was rainy, and then you come around to race day and it's relatively dry again. That was a bit of a trick, wasn't it?
It was funny looking back at it now because it was so bizarre. I'd been fairly fast all the weekend in the wet conditions at Donington, but my first dry lap on the bike was actually the warm-up lap for the race at Donington. So I went out in the warm-up lap and I thought there was something wrong with the steering because in the wet you don't get a correct impression of the bike. So I was thinking of a 250 trying to turn the handlebars and steer the bike and thinking there was something wrong with the 600, but I began the race and I had a bad qualifying because I crashed in the drying conditions in final qualifying at Donington, so I found myself down 21st on the grid, and instead of going forwards at the beginning I found myself going backwards at every corner because I just didn't understand what the bike was going to do next. So coming into every corner, I didn't want to brake late because for all I knew, the rear could come round on me. So there was guys coming around me inside, outside, and it was just a little bit bizarre for the first few laps. But from the start of the race to the end, my lap times improved by something ridiculous, like 4 seconds. And at the end of the race, I actually ended up lapping quicker than my teammate Brock Parks. So I knew what I was capable of at the next round of Awalunga, but I guess nobody else realised because I'd only got to finish 12th at Donington because of the weekend we'd had with the weather conditions. So I was just glad that at Awalunga I was actually able to get the result just to have it in black and white and show people that's what I could do.
And Vallelunga, you know, you talked briefly about the race, but that certainly was a bit of a storied race. One of for people that haven't seen it yet, and I can't imagine who has, but it was fantastic to watch in a real battle at the front. The one thing that stuck in my mind when you were riding the R6 there was that you were still carrying corner speed and your lines much like a 250, and it was very impressive because that is not easy to do on that heavy of a bike. Talk me through that race a bit if you could.
Well, it was an interesting race because in the morning warm-up that morning I got to follow a few of the regulars like Johnny Ray and Juan Last Course and got to see what they were doing differently, and a lot of what I learned in the 250 really helped me on the 600. And I was able to put that to good use, but I was able to see when I followed them there was quite a few things I was doing wrong, and especially through the three left corners I was losing so much time because my left foot was injured and I just couldn't put the pressure on the footrest to really throw the bike in fast. But in the race itself, I got an injection in my foot and it allowed me to make up the time I was losing in those corners and be able to hang with the guys at the front. So it was strange to watch back at the race and see how different my lines were in a few areas. And, of course, that's why myself and Andrew Pitt ended up colliding, because on the corner where we came together, I had a different line to enter early, drift out wide and come back to the apex. But when I came back, Andrew was there. And just one of those racing incidents, and these things happen. And fortunately for me, I stayed on and got to stand up in the box.
And I have no idea how you stayed on, because at a certain point, I think both your wheels were a good 6 inches in the air, and
that's right.
I was pretty sure that you were heading down. What were you thinking after the end of that get-together?
I don't know how I stayed on it myself. I think because I'd run a little bit wider than normal, I was looking on the peripheral vision to make sure Andy wasn't coming up the inside, and he caught me off guard because he came through quite a few kilometers an hour faster than me, so it hit into the side of me, and I lifted just in time, but it broke some of the front of the bike, broke the air scoop, and I just managed to stay on the bike. I didn't even realize I was on it, and I looked around me again and seen Andrew sliding up the road, and I just thought, I better get on with it now. So it was unfortunate for Andrew at the time, because it wasn't good for his championship, but these things happen in racing. And of course, he went on to win the championship in the end at the following round because of a silly mistake that another rider, Robin Arms, made on Johnny Ray. So I think what happened to Andrew wasn't just as unfortunate as what happened to Jonathan, because what happened to Jonathan was 100% not his fault.
Yeah, sure. That incident with Robin Harms, I think, had an awful lot of people talking. Back at Vallelunga, you mentioned earlier about how those three lefts before there were a place where you were falling behind, and you got to see them run through there in the warm up. And I think during the race, those were the places where you made up the most time. It was actually great to see that.
I didn't run injections in the foot all weekend because I just didn't want to do any more damage, and I thought I could manage okay all qualifying because I was still able to put the laps in, but it was okay for maybe 3-4 laps, and then I would start to miss gears on the back shift and hit false neutrals and run straight on and stuff. So between myself and the team manager, Wilco Zuhlenberg, we realized if I was going to run up at the front for the entire race, I was going to have to go for the injection, and I'm thankful that I did it because it really got me on the podium. Otherwise, I might have ended up dropping backwards a lot quicker.
And Wilco certainly had praise for you, both after Donington, frankly, and certainly after Vallelunga. But it was great seeing you on the podium, and it was certainly, you could see the look in your eye like, okay, I'm back where I want to be. So that must have been an awful lot of fun being up there, especially with Johnny joining you.
It was nice. Just it was such a relief walking out onto the podium because, like I said, after Donington, I knew you could do it. The team knew you could do it. But what was on paper was that I had a 12th place finish in a factory Yamaha at Donington. And after having come off two crap years in a 250, it really wasn't much good for me. People would have, of course, been saying, look, the bike isn't that bad. He only finished 12th on a good 600 Yamaha. So it just made everything so much easier to actually get the result, and that was that. I pretty much semi-retired for the year and haven't been on a bike since.
And so there you are, and you've got your podium, and now what? Fabian Frey is coming back. It's announced for the next race, and you're, although obviously you were having talks with Park Halgar at the time, nothing could be announced, and so you're sort of on a strange little vacation, which must have been a little odd.
It was. My season ended at Vallelonga, although it came to Magny-Cours just in case Fabian mightn't have been able to ride for whatever reason, and of course he turned up and he was fine, so I would have liked to rode Magny-Cours because that would have been one less track to learn next year. But at the time, when Cal Crutchlow got the Yamaha ride for 2009, I began to speak with Park Halgar, and soon afterwards I realized that's where I wanted to go. And I guess the rest of the guys, I sat out the last month of the season, so I've really had an extended winter break. So except for one day on the bike at Portimao, I haven't really had much time on the bike, so I'm just itching to get back rather than at this time of year, you're usually happy of a break.
So you've been off on the weekends and weekdays on the pushies and motocross bikes and trials bikes and all that, keeping in shape, of course.
Yes, this weekend I've been on the bike, the trials bike, Thursday, Saturday and Sunday. It was great fun on Thursday. Leon Haslam was over and Jeremy McWilliams was out and Gordon Cockard taught us a thing or two. So I really enjoy riding trials bikes in the winter because the weather isn't so good over here. It's difficult to ride so much motocross. I've only done a couple of days of motocross, but of course during the week, and if I'm not away trials riding at the weekend, I'm on my bicycle, usually in the turbo trainer indoors because of course the weather is so bad outside.
You know, you mentioned Jeremy McWilliams, and without giving anything away, I've heard some whispers that he might actually be coming over to the States this year. You can keep quiet on that if you choose to do so.
I haven't heard anything of that. Usually when we're out trials riding, there isn't much talked about racing. We usually just talk about who can go over the top of that rock and who can climb up that hill.
So of your mates, who's the best at trials?
Gordon Cockard is really good at trials. He could probably run at British Championship level on trials, so the rest of us have got balls of steel, and we'll try anything Gordon does, but usually we come tumbling down with the bike rattling us in the head afterwards.
I imagine the trials bikes, at least the crashers, are in slower speed, although you might end up with some awkward bends of the limbs.
It's quite dangerous because we seem to like to just climb up hills, and you have to tumble down it afterwards when you don't make it, and there's tree stumps and all sorts, so you get beaten about quite a bit. So I think in the next month I'm going to have to be a bit more careful. A few too many big crashes.
Are you mostly healed up? Feet and legs and everything seem well?
My feet are fine. I'm back running as part of my training, no problem, and it's not causing me any grief, so now I'm not having any after effects.
Are you a runner at all, or mostly on the bikes?
Mostly on the bikes. Usually, if I'm away, I always pack a pair of running trainers because you can't pack a bicycle in your suitcase, but there's no excuse for not training when you're away because you can always put in a pair of trainers and go for a run.
Yeah, somebody, I think you mentioned on your website that you got yourself a new indoor trainer. Is that what you were talking about?
That's right. I've got the turbo trainer to put the bicycle on, and I don't mind going out cycling in the cold weather, but it was two winters ago I really knocked it in the head because it just got to the point where I was out cycling and I couldn't see through my glasses, so I went to wipe whatever was off them, was on the front of them, and it turned out it was frost on them, so I thought, nah, I'm turning back, I'm going indoors. It was that cold. So from now on I'm just indoors pedaling away and watching usually Prison Break on TV.
television habits of our road racing stars. So, so tell me about Portimao. I know, you know, you said you were at Bagni Coors and same thing at Portimao. Were you there for the race, the whole race weekend?
I arrived at Bagni Coors on the Friday, and by the time Friday was finished, I'd seen enough bikes because I wasn't happy I wasn't riding. So I drove my motorhome back home on Saturday morning and just watched it on TV when I arrived back home. But at Portimao, I turned up and watched the entire weekend because I was going to be testing there a couple of days afterwards, so I tried to pick up anything I could. But it's always hard being there when you're not racing, and, you know, there's the possibility that you could. But it was nice watching Josh Hayes riding the Park Algarve bike because I think he was the strongest super sport rider that weekend. He didn't have the bike quite right for him, and I think if the bike had been to his liking, he would have really taken it to Keenan Sofiroglu, because I don't think people really got to see the best of Josh, and he really impressed me that weekend. He also helped me to learn the circuit and sat down and talked with me in the debrief and the test, and he was really helpful and just a genuinely good guy.
Yeah, I'm glad you had a chance to talk with him. I know that he's coming back here to race a superbike with Yamaha. There are a lot of us here in the States that would have preferred to see him over there, but there's only so many seats, and there's also always, you know, financial needs and whatnot. But either way, and it is funny that you mentioned that you basically had to leave the track, because there's nothing a racer likes, especially if he's healthy, than to be sitting at a track and not racing.
Yeah, I don't mind watching racing when it's my brother's racing with a superbike, because I know I'm not supposed to be racing there. I'm in a different series, but when I'm actually turning up watching the World Super Sport where I've been racing at Vallelonga just a couple of weeks before against those guys, I want them to be out there and racing in amongst them.
Now, speaking of the superbike guys, we had a whole trio of, or even more of, the British superbike boys that went over there and certainly did a great job.
I mean, where's that, sorry?
At Portimao.
Oh, yeah. That's right, in Portimao. The guys, Leon Haslam and Cal Crutzlow and a few others, they were pretty impressive all season, and it showed how strong the British Superbike Championship is, and now it seems that Yamaha have signed up the whole lot. They've got Tom Sykes in World Superbike and Cal Crutzlow in World Supersport, and then Leon Camier in British Superbike, so they're picking up all the talented guys from British Superbike, and it's great because with Johnny Ray and guys like that at the front, it's allowing the younger guys to come through afterwards and really paving the way for them.
And on top of that, it will probably make your time in the series even better, because you'll have some of your mates around to, you know, BS and hang out with instead of being sort of off there by yourself.
We've been talking about that. It's crazy how many guys are going to be there. I think there's maybe 7 or 8, and we all get on well together. So it's going to be like a little mini British Superbike crowd in the World Superbike paddock all hanging out together.
So we pretty much know where security is going to be looking most Sunday nights trying to find
places.
Moving on, and yeah, Josh had a great result, and Simon certainly gave him a thumb up and had some especially interesting words about his not only his performance but his interaction, if you will, with Sofiroglu, who's going to be one of the guys you're going to certainly be fighting with next year. Simon, yeah, you know, once that all happened, you know, certainly Josh really didn't have a whole lot of ideas about why, but regardless, it was a great race and a great finish. So a couple of days later, or a day later, you're back there, and tell me what you thought about the circuit and about the bike.
The circuit, I would have to say, is the best circuit I've ever ridden. It really is incredible, because most of the new circuits, like Qatar and Sepang, they're all great circuits because they're wide and the surface is good and they've got good curbing on the outside, but they're quite boring because they're flat, whereas Portimao, some of the climbs and descents were incredible. You were only going maybe 30% throttle over some rises, hanging right over the front of it just to try and get the front of the bike down so you could get the power on, and I really enjoyed it. It was a difficult circuit to learn, so it was nice to have Josh there just giving me little pointers, because there's so many corners that were blind, and there was there really isn't anything to go by in the corners. You, in some areas, you almost have to just count 1, 2, 3, and then try and enter, and hopefully you're going to make it towards the apex.
Did you ride the bike as it had been set up for Josh, or were you on a different bike?
I tried a few different settings because Craig Jones, when he rode the bike this year, he liked the bike very loose, and he is an incredible talent, Craig. What he could do in a bike, I don't think anybody else could ride a bike in the sort of way that Craig did. He was always sideways, whereas I like the two wheels in line. I'm a different kind of rider, so I tried the way Josh had changed the bike and a little bit the way Craig had set the bike, and generally I steered towards the way Josh had it. So I know what direction we need to go for the next test in January, and we got to try quite a bit.
That's good. There wasn't anything published, but were you satisfied with your times?
I was still taking big chunks off at the end. Even in my last stint of the day, I took 3/4 of a second off. So I was pleased. Cal Crutchlow went really fast in the end, quite a bit quicker than me, but I wasn't too bothered about that because I know myself that I had rode the Yamaha, and it's so well set that anybody can hop on it and go fast right away. Cal had been testing there for a few days, so I wasn't too worried about that, but definitely Cal showed his strength, and how fast he's going to be next year, he's going to be hard to work with on a competitive package.
Yeah, that's good. You know, I mean, frankly, you've got time there. You've got you know what, probably at least half the tracks in the World Superbike Supersport.
Yeah, I would say maybe 2/3 of the circuits.
Okay. I guess all the GP crossover, even if you were on a bit of a nail when you were running those, at least you know where the tracks go.
Well, that's one good thing about it, because I was on such a nail, I had to do every little bit of homework that I could just to try and get that little bit, there's a tenth of a second here and there, and that's something that Chulo Checanello taught me very well in 2007, so I know of the tracks that I rode on the Grand Prix calendar, I know them inside out.
And you know, you mentioned that you were running some of Craig's settings, or at least trying those out, and you and I haven't talked about this before, but you are stepping into a bit of a storied position with taking this bike and Craig's after his horrible and unfortunate accident earlier this year, and God bless him. But I know that they did a tribute there on, I believe, Sunday afternoon in honor of him. And so going forward, you're it's a strange place to be in, but I'm sure you're going to be holding up your end of the bargain and moving on with the team. So now what? Now what do you do? You've got a fair amount of time. What kind of testing do you have planned for the off season?
The first test will be in January. The first official one is back at Portimao.
Okay.
It's the first official FG Sport test, and there's a possibility I might get a test in Spain before then too. So I think we have a few tests scheduled before the bikes have to leave in the middle of February, because the first race is quite early. It's the 1st of March in Phillip Island, so it wouldn't really be long in coming round, and before we know it, we'll be kicking off the season.
And the World Superbike season is even longer, if we could say, than the GP season. It's a long time, but you'd be away and on the road. You prep for that?
Yeah, I didn't mind the traveling as much this year, I have to say. I think your body just adjusts to it, so I'm not just as worried about it, whereas in 2007, the traveling really did kill me. The first time I went to Qatar, I got badly ill, and then in time I lost out in sleep, I just really couldn't manage, because I always liked my sleep, whereas now I can get away if I lose out in sleep, I can still function, whereas before I struggled to walk if I missed out in a couple of hours sleep. So I don't mind that so much, and it's a different way of life to your normal 9-to-5, but I've got used to it.
Good. And so do you have any big plans for your off season, or just training and preparing and getting yourself ready?
Mainly training. I'm trying to organize in December and possibly January as well for me and my brother Michael and maybe Chaz Davies and a few other guys to go over to Mallorca for a week cycling, which would be nice, and some hot weather. And of course we'll do our annual ski holiday it's we're going to go away at the start of January, I think, to either France or Austria. So I'm looking forward to that.
Ah, fun. This should be good. All right. Well, I'm trying to think if there's anything else. Did Chaz tell you any of his plans or anything you can tell me, or you got to tell me offline?
No, I haven't spoke to Chaz about his plans yet. The only thing I spoke to him about the other night was he asked me what my ID was on the Xbox 360 I just bought.
What are you playing?
All my mechanics at Parc Algar have got Xboxes and bought the new Gears of War game, so they all said to me to buy it, and I've played probably all of about 45 minutes on it, and I just really can't get into it, so I bought Guitar Hero and got the guitar, and I'm just rocking it out in my own room here.
All right, well, listen, Eugene, I thank you very much for your time, and best of luck to you between now and obviously next year. We'll try and get a chance to talk to you perhaps before the Portimao practice in, I believe, January, you said. And so thanks for your time, and thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
No problem. I'll be on again soon.
All right, cheers.
Okay, we have Liam Schubert on the phone, and Liam is in Barcelona still. How you doing, dude?
Hey, everybody. It's been a while, I guess, since we've spoken.
Yeah,
and
it's been quiet.
I've kind of been handling a lot of stuff this year. I think that's been fairly obvious to people that have either followed the website or followed the thread on BARF or things on RideOnTube. But basically, I've decided to move back to the United States, back to the Bay Area, California, and work on different projects. And, well, it's going to be a big change for me, I think, because, one, I've got gotten used to living out here, and two, I'll be at a distance from the racing.
Yeah, but and you're also going to be in one place for more than like a month at a time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that'll probably be the biggest change. It feels like the last couple of years I've just been on warp drive, where if you remember any of the movies from Star Wars or Star Trek, when they go into warp drive, all the stars kind of become solid lines flying past, and that really feels, if I had to generalize my life for the last few years, feels like I've been in warp drive because I'm constantly on the move or planning for the next week or, you know, get back and try to do laundry and hammer out some reports and figure out what's going on for the next couple of weeks, if I'm going to be out of the house for a week or 8 weeks or whatever. And, you know, I see people, the friends that I've made around the world, and to me it's like, oh, wow, I haven't seen you in a little while. It's just, or I just saw you. Like, oh, we just caught up a couple of weeks ago, it feels like. And they're like, Liam, it's been a year. And I go, but nothing's changed, right? You know, you're still the same person. And for me, it was really strange. It really became apparent this year in 2008 that, you know, a lot of things were happening in other people's lives. You know, they were either having children, or they picked up this motorcycle and this was happening in their world, or they got a new house or whatever. And they're like, what's new with you? And I said, well, GPA, it's more or less the same, so not too much is new. I'm still on the roller coaster ride. So in a lot of ways, I was continuing to develop professionally and with my job, and looking more about the racing and the little countries that we go to. But on another level, I was feeling like, wow, I'm kind of missing out on standard life. And I started to feel a little bit of, I started to feel a little bit of pressure as far as time, because I'm in my mid-30s, early to mid-30s, and it was an odd feeling for me, because I kept thinking, wow, I'm advancing professionally, but there's other aspects of my life that aren't really growing right now. And it was difficult for me to find a balance with that. So I looked long and hard at the opportunities I had at the end of the season. I could have switched to other teams in GP, or I had a great opportunity in 125 to help develop something new. And I have a couple of really close teammates, former teammates, that are working in World Superbike now for factory teams. So that was also an option. And, you know, it really emphasizes the fact that racing is it's a small community, and it's really based on relationships. You know, who trusts you and believes that you can do the right job or a better job than they expect. The kind of thing where 3 years ago I would have been amazed to be able to say, oh, I know this guy in World Superbike, or I know this guy that works for this team. I think at the beginning of my career, when I was emailing a lot to team managers and so on, it was like more of like a, you know, you throw the football and you kind of see where it lands, and it's like, oh, cool, I got a reply from Paul Denning or Davide Brivio from Yamaha, and it was, you know, it was pretty special to get those emails back then. But now, you know, after a couple of years of seeing these guys week in and week out, where you say, hey, Paul, how's it going? Or, oh, rough weekend. Or, you know, when you build up more of a relationship, they know you by face and name. And, you know, we all work in the same small town that changes places. Things kind of change. The perception changes. So now, you know, I was talking to somebody on Skype 30 minutes ago, and my buddy Sergio pings me on Skype, and he's like, oh, yeah, I'm still working. We're working on the Yamaha R1, the 2009 factory bikes that we're going to be racing in Superbike. And Sergio's going to be the track engineer, the chief mechanic for Tom Sykes. So he's going to have the same equipment as Ben Spies, and it's the same team. And, you know, for me, it's normal. Just like, these are my friends and my connections that I've made, and really strong connections over the last 3 years, because we've all been on Warp Drive, and feels like we've known each other for 10 years. That's the only comparable type experience I can put it to. Like, I've known these guys forever now, because we've dealt with so much newness at the same time, and so much adversity and bonding, that, you know, I just go, hey, what's going on, Sergio? What's the dyno say about the bike? You know, and he says, well, the dyno says we need 200 cc's more like the Ducati. So, I mean, that's really funny to think about. If I'm speaking with you or the people on MotoGPOD, but for me, it's just like, oh, cool, I talked to Sergio today, you know, and you know, we'll shoot the stuff about his new bike. And the same goes for Lele, who's working on the factory Aprilia, mostly with the development with Nakano, and also in GP, because I still am quite connected to a lot of folks in Grand Prix. But personally, I stepped back and I looked and I said, okay, what do I really want to accomplish in the next few years? I was starting to see that for me to make the type of step that I wanted to make in GP, I needed to come up with a different plan, because I didn't want to just be a piece of the machine anymore. From my perspective and the direction I want to go, it became apparent to me that I was going to have to do something a little outside the box again, so to speak. And I want to do that. You know, I still have a lot of great feelings and a lot of strong emotion concerning the races, but it was a little different for me in 2008, because I didn't have my full crew, like
squadra.
Yeah, I didn't have my full squadra working with me, and there was a lot more drama and politics this year than I really was comfortable with.
You know, I was going to say, like to be honest, like, it seemed like 2007 for you was a very exciting, positive year. You were always positive, and this year you kind of started shutting down a little bit.
Yeah, I. There became a lot more things that I couldn't really share with everybody. And, you know, those things will never come to light. But suffice it to say that I wasn't as excited to be there. And I know this is going to sound like sacrilege to some people, because so many people would say that, oh, I'll give my left arm to do that, or you're so lucky for being there. At this stage, you know, that's a little bit behind the curve. That's immaterial. Yes, I needed to be lucky to get in here. Yes, I put myself in the position to get lucky. And thirdly, I did get lucky. But then it's a job, you know, and we're all pushing to get results. And, you know, for whatever reason, if we're not getting results,
well, I wasn't thinking about the results. I mean, I'm just thinking that, you know, the team went through some serious changes this year.
Absolutely, absolutely. More than I'd say any other team in the top level has gone through. Never has a team principal been shifted out of the picture mid-season.
Yeah, exactly.
The last big change like that occurred when Kawasaki brought their program in-house and shifted Harold Eckel out of the scene in the preseason a few years back. And even then, it wasn't a complete... They didn't say, okay, you are out, and we're going to build our own in-house team. What they did is they said, okay, you are out, and then everybody else within the existing team structure took a step up and started running things. So it wasn't, you know, I wouldn't say it was as drastic as what happened to us in the midseason, where, you know, we were getting through 6 races in 8 weeks, and towards the end of that, Dantin was all of a sudden gone.
Right.
And Primack took control, and for us that meant a lot of shifting, because now we had to change everything over into Primack's name just to keep things legal and keep the ball rolling. It became a question of like, okay, what semi-trucks are we going to use?
It's almost as crazy as changing tire brands in the middle of the season.
I'd say it's more crazy. Because, you know, changing tire brands is just a technical aspect of the motorcycle and the rider.
Oh, you got the stickers and contracts and stuff.
Yeah, that's true. There were quite a few contracts and maybe some money that had to do with that. And I don't know. My perspective is the same. Like, I just read an interview with Tom Houseworth on Road Racer X, and the viewpoints are the same. Like, oh, okay, if you can basically break down any of the problems to logistics or, you know, as far as getting used to traveling, getting used to the racetracks, like Ben Spies has to do. And the rest of it's all a technical matter. Like, okay, we need to learn a new bike and new tires and a new circuit. That's technical. And I think at this level, you know, anytime you get into a highly competitive arena, once you've proven you can do it, it's no longer a giant drama like, oh, you know, we're hitting a rev limiter in third coming out of this corner, or we're just not getting as much drive as we could get going through here, this section. That becomes all technical, and you break it down, and you look at what your solutions are, like, okay, we can juggle the transmission ratios and come to this point. We can change the gearing. We can alter the engine braking. We can do so many things, and it's just a technical problem and a question of, okay, let's make the right changes to the bike and go in the right direction, and boom, you make the changes, and the next time the bike goes out, that problem's solved, and you look for a different problem. I think a lot of things are a lot easier for me in a way, because I no longer, well, it's not new, let's put it that way. I think it's the same for everybody when you start a different job. The initial problems you experience, you know, get knocked down because of it through experience. Once you have enough experience with that type of problem, it's second nature now. So in a way, at least with my position, 07 was a huge learning year for me, and then in 08 I was halfway in neutral on some positions, because I knew what to expect as far as the bikes and maintenance requirements, and the big crashes didn't really freak me out at all anymore. Mm-hmm. Because I knew what to do to handle that and how to plan for the future to replace what I could rebuild my inventory and so on and so forth. So I spent more time concentrating on the data and learning a little bit from more of the people around me, whether they were engineers that were actually involved in design of the electronics or the physical characteristics of the bike, the vehicle design people. And just really taking a harder look at my life, like, okay, I've done the mechanic work, so I know that what's required to do that inside and out. I've now seen the logistics aspect of things, and I know what's required to keep a team running, especially through the whole Dan Keene shuffle in the middle of the season. And for what I want to do and what I want to accomplish, I'm not going to say right now, but I do want to change things up. And in the midst of my coming to the decision that I did to leave to take a hiatus from racing right now, it was also clouded and influenced a lot by the decisions that the series organizers are making. I can't emphasize enough how unhappy I am that we're going to a single tire. And this is not because I love Bridgestone or I love Michelin. You know, I don't care who is racing, but for this particular arena, this is prototype Grand Prix. And people will say, oh, you're just being a purist, or you're just, you know, you want to keep it to some mystical level. It has nothing to do with that. It just has to do with being on, you know, the widest variety of equipment that people can come up with. I want to know that every factory is doing their best to build something, every rider is doing their best to make their package work, and that's, you know, kind of what all of us are doing. You know, the general mood concerning the tire announcement when it was made was, first it was like shock and fear, like we didn't want it to go to one tire, and then when it was finally announced that it was going to one tire, we treated it almost like a joke, like, are you serious? We're going to have to choose between soft and hard. And if it's too hard, you use the soft. And if it's too soft, well, you're out of luck. You know, it just kind of threw everybody for a loop. Like, what the, you know, are you serious? This is MotoGP.
Yeah, and especially because they tried it, you know, last year too, and it got killed. So nobody really thought it was going to happen this year.
Yeah, it's definitely a kick in the head, because, I mean, the example to look at is, Bridgestone did so much of the development work with Ducati and Marlboro in the last few seasons, and they have a dedicated tire development team from Bridgestone, the tire test team, Triple T. And, you know, Bridgestone made a tire that worked well with the Ducati, and Casey was able to use that, and they got so much information from him and his riding through 2007, and then Valentino comes in and starts using that material developed by Casey, and within four races, he's now up to speed and winning and challenging for wins. And I think if you look up any of the technical articles that have come up, either from Neil Spaulding or whoever, you see that they basically altered the geometry and the chassis of the Yamaha to emulate the Ducati.
Right. And Suzuki started doing the same thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And Kawasaki's working on the same thing now. So, in my mind, now we've got a whole bunch of factories, and the race is no longer to build the fastest Kawasaki or the fastest Honda that they can. It's now we're working really hard to make the fastest Bridgestone bike we can.
Yeah, dude, that's wild.
And it's just it's an unsettling, it's an odd feeling for me to think, oh, okay, who's going to have the most Bridgestone bike next year? And I don't know. You can say that this is the state of racing in the world right now, because World Superbike is obviously running a control tire. And, you know, are all the teams building bikes just for those tires? It's difficult to say, because at least those bikes have those bikes are sold commercially.
Yeah, they don't have as much leeway to swing the thing back and forth, you know?
Right. You know, you've got Yamahas that seem to work really well on certain racetracks with the Pirelli, and then at other tracks they're completely out of the game with the control tire. And you have to ask yourself, let's take a step further back and look at the development of this. Does the stock Yamaha come equipped with Pirellis for the street? Or does Yamaha have a giant contract with Dunlop, that all OEM bikes come with Dunlops, for example? You know, and when you go and test for a magazine, and when you're trying to sell your product to the public, you know, what tires are they running? Is it, are you going to run your World Superbike spec tire, or are you going to run, you know, what the bike comes equipped with? So there's a lot of...
Well, what do you think actually motivated Dorna to do this? I mean, what was the motivation behind this? Because it's not safety and it's not cost. Is it just they're worried about this close racing thing and that they're going to lose audience? I mean...
I don't really want to say what my personal opinion is.
What?
Because I still work in the racing community.
Okay. Fair enough.
For the record, I'm still under contract with my team, so I can't really disclose a lot about technical issues. But I think there's a lot of factors involved when you consider a giant move to a single tire like this. One, obviously, is television. You want to have close racing. You want to have riders stop complaining and pointing fingers and saying he's got better material or he's got the Bridgestones. We can't fight. Because it's a black eye to the series when it's really out of balance.
We had runaway races between guys with the same tires. How's that going to change that?
Exactly. And there's always been runaway races from the very beginning of motorcycle racing.
Yeah.
You know, people could win by a minute. People could win by 16 seconds. People could win by however far they could win. You know, that it comes down to the rider just getting on the gas, and if he's in the frame of mind to go out and destroy everybody, no one's going to stop that rider. And, you know, it follows my personal belief that it all comes down to what's going on in the rider's head. Because, you know, all the bikes, as different as they are and as different as the tires are, it still comes down to the rider at the end of the day.
Yeah, yeah. But I think that if it was a question of, like, Bridgestone and... Like, half the field being on Bridgestones and half the field being on Dunlops the way Dunlops were, like, in 2005 through 2007, you know, then I could say, oh, yeah, then it makes absolutely no sense to have two tire brands because one's getting slaughtered. But Michelin and Bridgestone are pretty much even Stevens, you know. They're just, it's just wacky.
Yeah, let's just say I'm not really happy about it.
Okay.
And I don't really... I'm curious to see if they're going to actually be able to come up with a legal way of distributing equal material to everybody, because it's at Bridgestone's discretion to make a tire that serves everybody without favoring one particular bike or another, which will be a challenge.
Yeah.
And secondly, the proposal I heard was good as far as saying, okay, for example, you're going to get 100 tires for everybody, and we're going to number these tires 1 through 100, and then randomly each team will get 10 of these tires, and the numbers will be random, because it's a pretty obvious to me that if you make 100 tires, you know, maybe through your production process the first 10 tires are going to be amazing,
right,
and the next 80 are going to be okay, and the last 10 are going to be completely crapped out.
Right.
You know, so there's a lot of different ways that you can make 100 tires. And then there's the aspect that, you know, is everyone going to run the same tire pressure? You know, what keeps things even? Racing is never about being fair.
Well, the other thing I heard also was that, you know, like, mm-hmm. Colin Edwards said this, that he's concerned that the Bridgestone is going to, you know, use their best riders to develop the tires, and that those tires might not fit the riding style of the rest of the field anyway. So you're not going to have those 100 tires, but they're all going to be Rossi tires or Stoner tires.
Well, I don't know if they're making Stoner tires anyway. No, I think Bridgestone will keep it fairly competitive. You know, it's obvious that the show is important on one level. It worries me about, you know, the smaller riders that have peculiar needs like Pedrosa or Elias. But maybe, you know, really small riders will be phased out in the next 5 years. Maybe we'll start having riders of a normal size that are 5'10" or 6 foot tall and skinny, like, you know, Ruben Chaos or Troy Bayliss or what have you.
Right.
You know, maybe a more neutral tire will allow people like Rossi, who's a standard, you know, fairly standard sized guy, to stay competitive against people that are a lot lighter than him. This is the dumbing down in a way of racing that is allegedly going to keep everybody in the game up to a point.
Well, the dumbing down was when they went to, it didn't work, but when they went from 900s to 990s to 800s, I think is when these problems started. And, you know, now they're going to start cutting up bit by bit the whole prototype thing. You know, it's like, what's next? The bikes are going to get faster in the corners still, and so the safety's not going to get improved, so they're going to...
Maybe Bridgestone will intentionally make the tires so that the backs slide a lot, or the front's not so good. You know, maybe Bridgestone will make it so that the 800s will emulate the 990.
Yeah, but you're not making the best race bikes and best race tires anymore. So what's the point of running a MotoGP type series?
Well, maybe it's just going to be another World Series.
Yeah, I guess so.
Not the.
Anyway, we could talk about this for hours, I'm sure. I think that the listeners of this show are going to be like, "Oh God, they're going about the tires again." So. Let's switch topics to your impressions of the GP9. I know you can't say too much about it, but just like, you know, overall impression of the bike.
Of what, GP9?
Yeah.
GP9 is incredible.
Jaw-dropping?
I think the bike is...
Jaw-dropping? Yeah.
Give me chicken skin the first time I crawled around one, which says a lot for me, because I don't really get... shocked or surprised by things the way I used to, but the bike is just absolutely beautiful in so many different ways. And eventually, when photos come out and people start getting more information about this machine, it's amazing. And I almost feel like it's going to be too good for the tires. You know, like it's, you know, I think in my mind that there's the three aspects of there's the bike, the tires, and the rider. And you know, every couple of years, one makes a step up and then pulls the other ones with it in the next few years. Like you saw Gary McCoy make his advances, and then tires and tire companies and chassis designers brought their level up, and then Rossi took it to another level, and then, you know, Casey took it to yet another level last year with Ducati.
Yeah, you could go back to, like, the late 70s and 80s and say, you know, chassis overtook... the tires, and then tires overtook the chassis, and then you had Kenny Roberts and those guys who stood.
Yeah, absolutely.
Style. It's been like this.
You know, this is the nature, nature of the motorcycle racing. So I think,
well, development. Motorcycle
personally, I think the GP9 is a huge step as far as understanding how motorcycles work and making them go around a racetrack fast. The bike is just beautiful. I mean, the level of detail that the little factory has shown for all aspects of this bike is incredible. And I can't believe that they're running on 10% of the staff that HRC has.
That is amazing.
It's an incredible machine. And it's really going to be a testament to the designers and the engineers, you know, the small crew that put this machine together. Based on how it does next year, you really have to take your hat off to Ducati Corsa and their vehicle design group and the electronics people, because it's taking another step up again, not just in the chassis and the bits and pieces of the bike, but the electronics are taking a step up. It's beautiful, really, really beautiful.
So,
wish I could talk about it more.
Is Ducati going to win next year, the championship?
You can't ever make a blanket statement like that. I think the bike has the potential to sweep the championship, of course. But then it depends on the rider also, how well he's able to utilize it. You can give the best gun in the world to somebody, and if they can't shoot straight, what's the point?
Oh, of course, of course. But Yamaha really made a giant leap to catch up with a Ducati this year. Do you think this is going to be another game changer like 2007? For the Ducati guys?
Depends on the tires. I think it depends on the tires because using the gun analogy that I just used, you can have the best gun in the world, and if your bullet doesn't fly straight, you're fucked again. So
that's true.
You know, there's a lot of details and factors that are going to come into play next year. I know Casey's got what it takes. I know the bike looks to have a lot of good things going for it. And let's face it, at the Valencia test, it's not like the times were horrible. The times were great. So maybe the spec tire is going to be a good thing. You know, I could be completely off base, and I wouldn't mind being proven wrong at all as far as seeing times continue to drop year after year. Because Bridgestone obviously has made steps forward, and they could continue to improve, and it might raise the level of racing. I don't know. I just know that GP9 is incredible. And, you know, when I was at the factory last week, was it last week or week before? You know, I had the chance to sit down and have dinner with one of the vehicle engineers, and we discussed so many details and pieces. And it's just, for me, you know, not being an active engineer on any of these parts, it's, you know, I'm more in the field. That's what we refer to it when you go out to the races or you're in a different city, whatever, you're in the field. For me, it's like you can say, okay, well, about this part number and this piece, you know, we noticed this problem at the racetrack, or this was the result when we went to this generation of this piece. And to hear someone say, oh, we analyzed that, you know, we went with this, we thought this would be a better solution, and so on and so forth. It was just such a nice, honest communication back and forth that, you know, I really came away with a deeper understanding and a deeper appreciation of that machine. It's, you know, I hope it shocks the world. And I don't care who makes it, honestly. You know, I've always said I don't really have a particular favorite rider, and I don't have a particular favorite brand of motorcycle. I think if Honda had developed this bike, it would be the same sense of awe that I have for it. Like, wow, this is really something special. And I hope that carries the same weight for everybody listening as it does for me, because when I say that something is special, at this point in my career, having seen, you know, the changes from the 990 to the 800, you know, when they were these amazing pieces of technology. GP9 is awe-inspiring. And I think if Ducati can find a way to put this material to the street in the next 5 years or a decade, it's just really, really amazing. Really amazing.
That's cool. So is it, I mean, you were talking about that Ducati is, you know, has 10% of the staff dedicated to these racing projects. What about budget-wise? I mean, that's probably even smaller percentage than HRC.
I would say yes. I mean, obviously money comes in from Shell and from Marlboro, particularly, to fund Ducati Corsa. But, and I guess at this point, the power company in Italy, those types of details I don't have any access or knowledge of. I don't really follow the economic side of things the way I might. I don't know how much Honda is developing, you know, buckets of money just to fund HRC. You know, from what I've heard rumor-wise, with the budget cuts that went down through their AMA program and how much they're actually spending on World Superbike, maybe it's not some giant pot of gold that Honda's got. I would think that if you just looked at racing on an economic point of view and you said, okay, whoever spends the most money is going to win, then I would think Honda could just, you know, decimate the field with the amount of global material that they produce and sell. So maybe they don't have all this money. I don't know.
Well, I mean, obviously the budget is bigger if they can hire 2,000 people.
Right? This is true.
I mean, this is true. That's usually the most expensive part of any budget. All right, so the GP9 is kicking butt. How do you think Nikki's going to do on it?
How do I think Nikki's going to do?
Yeah.
I think this is the kind of machine where it's going to force the rider to really re-examine his technique. And it's going to force the rider to make as big of a step as, say, going from being a, I'll explain it in a way that other people might have an easier understanding of. J.D. Beach, young American kid, really fast on a flat track machine, a little bit of dirt track, you know, a motocross, then you throw him on a GP125 road racing bike, he has to make a huge step as far as changing how he rides a motorcycle and understanding what it takes to go fast and seeing other people, you know, ripping around on corners at speeds that he's never gone on the dirt. So he had a tough year, and then he came back and he won the Red Bull Rookies Cup Challenge this year.
Right.
So J.D. Beach has definitely made the adaptation. I think GP9 is a similar step for a rider, because it's one thing when the bike's all together, you know, and the fairings are on, and you just go and you sit on the seat, and it's got two handlebars and standard forks, and, you know, you can turn the handlebars and twist the gas, and it's a motorcycle in this aspect. So, you know, for the rider to go out there and ride it, that's one thing. But then when you see the bike, and you know the electronics behind it, and it's a lot more complex and detailed than any other machine you've come across, then you have to be able to tell your brain, okay, put all that stuff aside. As soon as I get out of pit lane, it's two handlebars and a gas and two wheels, and just go. So I think Nikki's definitely got the work ethic and the attitude to make it work for him, but I think it's going to be a big adaptation for him.
Oh, I totally agree. I think at Indy, when I saw him coming around that last corner each lap during qualifying, and he was smoking the rear tire going through that corner, I started having my doubts about, you know, how easy it would be for him to adjust. And in Valencia, my God, I mean, like, the way Stoner goes through that last corner and the way Nikki was going through the last corner, completely different. Completely different. So yep. Even though they come from the same kind of background, I think for Stoner it may have been easier because he did it so early on. He had to adjust so quickly. And Nikki has been able to kind of get away with his sliding it in style for so long, having it really loose. You know, people are always saying, well, Stoner's riding the bike really loose. But that's a completely different thing than Nikki riding his bike loose and Stoner riding his bike loose, because Stoner basically just stays on the throttle and lets the bike ride itself. And Nikki's of the old, you know, everything's control, steer with the rear style.
Mm. The only answer or the response that I have to that statement, those statements, the only thing I can say is, well, this is why we're going racing. We've got two different world champions in the same garage with the same bike, and we're going to see which one can get around the racetrack faster. I will say, personally, I loved watching Nikki this season. The second half of the season was just really beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you, as a fan, can put aside all the drama and the garbage that goes around in the press, like, oh, he's being screwed over this way, or, you know, he's switching to Ducati, or, you know, just put all that shit aside and just watch him come bombing through a corner and lighten it up. Beautiful. Just absolutely poetry on wheels. So, you know, this is an aspect of the racing that I've forgotten about, in a way. You know, I've done over 50 GP races now, and I don't remember the last time I watched a race. It's been a little while since I've actually just watched a race and enjoyed it without analyzing everything I could see. And that comes from every bike, because at one point, you know, you only look to see your rider, so you can see what the bike's doing, and you can kind of understand his feedback a little bit more. And, you know, when he says, oh, I was coming through here, and the bike was doing this, and you actually saw that on the video, it really makes it easier to translate back and forth this understanding. Then you get to a point, and you just start analyzing every single bike on TV. And it really
makes it hard to actually watch the race.
Yeah. You know, to be honest with you, I had to check to see who won Valencia this year. Valencia was the most recent race. And a couple of weeks ago, I was thinking, well, geez, who won that race? Like, what the fuck? I couldn't even remember who won that race. I had to look it up online.
Right.
And I just went, holy smokes. You know, my normal brain is easily capable of remembering races and results for so many years, and then this most recent one, I didn't even remember at all. I went, wow. I knew where my guys had finished, but I didn't remember who won. And that was kind of an eye-opener for me, like a little bit of a shock. Like, whoa, am I this involved and this removed at the same time?
You know, a lot of musicians claim that they can't listen to a song without picking it apart. And so they don't actually hear the complete piece of music. They just hear the individual parts, and especially the instruments that they're familiar with or whatever. It's very similar.
Yeah, I would say the same. You know, and yeah. I thought this might be a danger for myself. When you study something so intently, it loses a little bit of its magic and mystique. Fortunately, we still have the human element involved in racing. So riders do have the ability to shock you and change the program. You know, when we saw De Angelis earlier this year start going really good in Mugello, that was kind of like a, oh, wow, look, there's a new guy running up towards the front.
Yeah.
And sure, you know, he was tailing Rossi and getting toes around the racetrack, but bottom line is that he kept it on two wheels behind Rossi for those laps. And,
right.
You know, that was cool. I miss riding a lot. I think that's another thing that's become more clear to me in this past season. And it sounds a little insignificant to people that have a couple bikes in their garage or they ride to work every day, and you know they're constantly around riding the way I used to be. You know, I wouldn't have thought that I'd miss it as much as I did. And you know, every time I've been back in the States, I'm able to ride either my girlfriend's bike or I get a hold of a Ducati and I'm riding a nice new piece of machinery. And I just miss riding because I don't do it out here. Either there's no time or access to a bike or a couple other reasons. But yeah, I miss that.
Well, dude, you're gonna be in the right place to do some serious riding in a few months.
Well, it depends how long I stay in California.
Yeah, well, you should get your jollies out here.
Yeah, definitely. I should be back at Christmas time because
cool.
I want to spend Christmas with my friends and loved ones. And my girlfriend and I are doing great. She says hi to everybody. She says hi, Jules.
Hey.
Yeah, in a way, I kind of feel like I've got to recharge myself with some of the basics that keep me going. And then another portion of my energies are going to be devoted to pursuing a couple of new ideas that I've come up with and that we've come up with in the last year. And I don't know, my sense of adventure is still as strong as ever. I think I just found out that Thanksgiving is this week. And yeah, I know. How crazy.
This is the Thanksgiving special. Didn't you know that?
Sheesh. It's what, in 2 days now? Man.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Thanksgiving's coming up, and I guess I'm thankful for all the people that I met. You know, I think it was really a fortunate thing for everybody involved. You know, one, I was lucky I had Barf and my website and the podcast and every other way to reach out to people and kind of inspire them. That I do believe and I do think that if you set your mind to something and you want to do something, you can do it. this has always been at the core of my personality and my my belief system, my ethos. I think that if you want to do something, you put everything behind it and you do it. And, you know, I've been lucky enough to be considered inspirational to a lot of people, and I've met a ton of people throughout my travels. Every single race, I meet somebody or groups of people, and they're like, wow, you know, I've been reading about you, or we listened to you on the podcast, and thanks for sharing, and I just want to say thank you to all of them back, because on one level, it makes me feel so much better than just being just a mechanic in GP or just another cog in the machine. Yeah, in a way, I've been able to touch a lot of people, and that's a really positive feeling for me to sit back. You know, if I think about this, you know, all these memories and experiences are going to be with me for the rest of my life.
I bet that everybody who's met you has totally changed their attitude towards racing, and you really have had an amazing effect. Everybody is excited to meet you, and they say, oh yeah, I saw Liam at Indy, or I saw Liam in Valencia, or wherever. I was in Japan and I saw Liam, and it's like you really touch a lot of people. It's great. And
I'm really thankful for. You know, hopefully I'll be able to continue touching people in a similar way. And I don't know, I still have a lot more to say, a lot more things to germinate and just kind of reflect on. I obviously haven't written so much since the middle of this season when things got a little touchy with the team. And I have a lot of stuff that I want to just get out of my system. And writing is writing and putting pictures up is one of the ways that I do that. So I've already decided that once I get back to California, I plan to continue writing about the 2008 season, and you know, and then take it from there once that's all done. And it does take a lot of time, and I just haven't had that amount of free time or brain space. But I will, and it's been emotional.
Yeah. We got to be along for the ride. So thanks very much.
Sure.
And we look forward to the movie.
Yeah. I mean. All right. Take care, everybody. Thanks, Jules.
Thanks, buddy.
Okay, that does it for the show. Thank you very much to Jim Race for catching up with Eugene and posting the interview for us. And, of course, to Liam Schubert, who's also celebrating his birthday this weekend. So, happy birthday, Liam. Hope to see you soon, buddy. And to everyone out there in MotoGP OD land, thank you very much for listening, for downloading the show. And stay safe out there and all that stuff. Take care. Ciao.